Howdy. It's season four. It's just started. It's starting right now. Now, for those who know me, you know that I never want to court any controversy. So our first guest of the new season is designer Carlos Marquez Linares. He's the designer of The Other Side of the Hill, which is being published by NAC War Games, as well as the designer of Imperial Fever, which is currently on the GMT P500. We're going to discuss controversial topics and his design approach in these two games. Bienvenido, Carlos. Thank you for coming on the podcast to chat about your designs. I gave you some questions that I prepared, but this first question was not one of them, so please indulge me. Why do you suppose we have never seen a published game about processing meat?
Why? Are you sure we haven't? I mean, if you look at that and you have all those 18XX games with trains and you have all that meat being brought from the Midwest to the east of the United States, I don't know if it's exactly about processing meat. It's certainly about transporting it.
Mm.
So I don't go around giving ideas.
Yeah, I suppose not. I think I remember Uwe Rosenberg's Le Havre. There's definitely a lot of meat, like cows being turned into meat.
Yeah, so
there's fish being smoked. But I think what I was really holding out for was little wooden pieces that were going to look like disassembled.
I have a game for that. City of the Big Shoulders. City of the Big Shoulders. It's about the rebuilding of Chicago and how the industry developed there. And you have to buy resources. And one of the resources you have companies from that time, mm-hmm. and you have Oscar Mayer, I think, is one of the companies there.
Yeah.
So you buy raw meat and then you sell it to the market. So I guess you're processing it, and the meat is little pink cubes.
Okay. It's very, I seldom think about Oscar Mayer as having been a real person. Mm-hmm. His greatest contribution to my life is definitely the shape of that one vehicle. It's like the Wienermobile. Like, I think about that a lot, but I don't really think about him as like a young meat magnate or like an entrepreneur, some impressive.
Yes, wieners have different connotations.
Indeed. So apparently I'm just not really plugged into like all these meat processing games or meat adjacent games. But I was just kind of curious about that. My list of games to play is always growing. So that's always good to kind of keep tuned into. I wanted to begin in earnest by talking about The Other Side of the Hill. So for our listeners, would you mind describing what your game The Other Side of the Hill is about?
Yes, it will be my pleasure, as it is my pleasure to be here, which I haven't said yet. The Other Side of the Hill is a simulation of World War II from the Axis side, more specifically from the German side. This is a game where players do not want to win the war, because that is impossible by design. Germany cannot win the war. It's going to win to lose the war anyway, but to accumulate prestige, which they can get from different sources. First, they can get it from their actions are heads of sections of the high command. There are four sections of the high command, the OKW, which is Hitler and his entourage, and they decide the military and political direction of the war. The head of operations, which handles reinforcements and the movements of troops on the map. The head of production, who is responsible for the allocation of resources for technological projects and strategic warfare. And the head of personnel, who has a hand in new appointments for generals. Okay, so these four sections of the high command are redistributed every year. Okay, so every year a different person may have one of those roles, and the actions that you carry out there and the success of the actions that you start there, they give you prestige points. Okay, the second source of prestige points is the generals that you control. It's like a bit of a worker placement game where you have German generals in your hand and you draw them at the beginning. And depending on the command positions where they are appointed and their military victories, that also grants prestige. Also, if you lose battles, if you are defeated, generals can be dismissed and you can lose prestige. And the third source of prestige is agenda cards. And this is like a stack of prestige points that are only revealed at the end of the game. Okay. One of these agenda cards is the OKW, which is a public card. And the OKW obtains prestige points if Germany has not collapsed by the end of the game, which is spring 1945. So if Germany manages to last as long as it did historically, then the OKW, the German government, gets prestige points, and also gets prestige points from the value of fanaticism. And we're going to look at fanaticism later because it's connected to another of the questions that you would be asking me. The other agenda cards are secret. Okay. They are dealt out to players, and they represent different interest groups within the German armed forces and the officers. And you have the conservative old guard, the pro-Nazi sympathizers, the allegedly politically neutral professionals, and the dissidents. And the dissidents are the real heroes of the games, because it is their goal to end the war as soon as possible, even at the cost, and probably at the cost, of the defeat of Germany, of the early defeat of Germany. If you have counted, there are five agenda cards, okay? But there are only up to four players. This implies that you are never certain whether there is a dissident player in the game, or even who the dissident player in the game is. They are playing a very dangerous game, whoever has that agenda card. I think what is original about this design is that its aim is to reflect the effects of the dysfunctions of command in the war: corruption, jealousy, interest groups, personal ambitions. And this effect is much larger in a totalitarian state. And that is why I chose Nazi Germany, because if you want to show the dysfunctions of the high command, you have to go for totalitarian states. Because in those states, usually it is in the dictator's interest to keep people under them bickering and fighting for trying to get better positions, while dictators keep the last decisions to themselves. That is certainly how Hitler worked. It's also how Franco worked in Spain, by, as he said, believe it or not, by staying out of politics, because he had the last word, so he let other people. So this is not a very rational way of running a country or running a war, having people compete with one another. Okay, so for instance, compare Nazism and the way military leadership was organized there with the way Eisenhower kept the Western coalition together, and how he dealt with the prima donnas such as Montgomery or Patton under his command. What Hitler did is that whenever somebody contradicted him once too often, and this once too often became increasingly earlier in time, he was clearly dismissed. I don't know if you know this anecdote about Eisenhower and Montgomery. They were discussing this white front or narrow front strategy in the West, and Montgomery got so heated about the argument that he started speaking in a loud voice, and Eisenhower put his hand on Montgomery's knee and said, Monty, don't forget I'm your boss. Okay, so that's how you deal with these problems in a democracy, where it is merit that takes you where it should take you. Whereas what is interesting about totalitarian states is that you have different games at play there, and much more definitely corrupted and twisted elements at play there, which makes it interesting for a game, but it also makes it interesting to show how this worked, because we have a warped idea of Germany in World War II as being a solid, perfect military machine, and it was far from it, and that is what the game tries to depict.
Given the variability of your player roles within high command, as well as the secret agendas and varying modes of play, because you've got a competitive version, a solitaire version, and a cooperative version, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So
there's even a semi-cooperative version as an optional rule in the game.
Yeah. But given those different modes in the different player roles, would you say then that that dysfunction is sort of what you wanted? Like, is that what you wanted to highlight or convey across all these different modes? Because I can imagine yes. that. Okay.
Yes, definitely. Because for instance, even when you're playing alone, okay, you can't choose the general you want for that battle. You have to look at who is the highest ranking officer and who can be chosen among the ones that you have. And you don't always, or you rarely get the best general for the battle. Mm. So yes, even in solo player, in solo play, you are affected by these dysfunctions. Yes, that's by design.
And this hasn't really been the focus of a published game before that I'm aware of, at least. As we've established, I'm not aware of all the published games about meat and other subjects. But I'm assuming that the name of your game comes from Liddell Hart's book of the same title. And that book is a tentpole for the, you know, the kind of clean Wehrmacht myth. I was just kind of curious, how does your design make a distinction between that myth and the historical record?
Okay, first of all, this was not Liddell Hart's quotation. This is a quotation by Wellington. Liddell Hart is doing, he's quoting Wellington when he refers to the battles he's been, and he's saying that he had to imagine what was happening on the other side of the hill. So the other side of the hill is a general term in historical and military history to refer to the other camp, to refer to your enemy. Okay. Mm. So this game is called The Other Side of the Hill because of Liddell Hart, but also because it deals with those people that I, you, most of us like to consider not us, which is the Axis side in World War II. But I think that your question is very interesting about the clean Wehrmacht myth. I have read Liddell Hart's book, and I have still to decide whether Liddell Hart let himself be deceived or he was playing into the Cold War narrative, you know, that to be made presentable as an ally, Western Germany, for the United States and for NATO in this new conflict against the Soviet Union. I think that the generals that he interviewed, such as Guderian or Rundstedt, especially Guderian, they were very clever because they were flattering Liddell Hart.
Yeah.
They were saying, all that we did, you spoke about this, you were the first one to speak about the Blitzkrieg, about looking for witnesses for the indirect approach, which is Liddell Hart's greatest contribution. So they were flattering him. So he felt very comfortable with this general. So it's a very interesting book to read. But like, you know, any other book, you don't have to believe everything right. he tells you or everything the generals tell you. You have to compare that with what you know from history, from different sources and so on. Okay. So yes, there is this clean Wehrmacht myth, and it has at least two sides. One side of this myth, and one which is not so frequently addressed, is the fact that if the generals had had their way, Germany wouldn't have won the war. If Hitler, who was an amateur, hadn't sort of intervened or mishandled the situation, if only the professionals had been led to handle the war, Germany wouldn't have lost the way it lost. And that's a lie. Okay. First of all, because no German general complained when Germany invaded Poland. When Germany invaded France, the Halder, who was the head of OKH, okay, only complained about the timing. He said they couldn't attack France in the winter, but he was okay when they attacked France in the summer. This very general Halder, who ended up in a concentration camp, by the way, and who was incidentally, he was recruited by the United States to help write the official history of World War II. Mm. So this Halder enthusiastically embarked on the project of attacking the Soviet Union. No German general had a problem attacking the Soviet Union. After the war, they all said it was a mistake. But during the war, Nobody complained about it. Maybe Goering. Goering was so happy about it. Okay? And when Germany declared war on the United States, but because it was Germany that declared war on the United States, it was not the other way around. When Hitler decided to declare war on the United States, no generals complained. Okay, so they can't really say the political direction of the war was wrong because they never complained during the war about it. Okay. And secondly, what the game allows you is to say, okay, so you think you can do it better than they did historically. Okay. So you can fight this war and you can do it better than you know the OKW did. So do it. Now you are the generals. You are these guys. And you know what? You can't do it better than historically, because the historical war, a war where Germany faced simultaneously the Soviet Union, the United States, and the United Kingdom, that is the greatest land empire and the two greatest sea empires, it simply could not be won. It could never be won. Germany could have never won this historical war. There are historians who maintain that Germany lost the war the minute Britain entered the war, because Britain had the ability to blockade Europe, and Europe couldn't feed itself, okay, which is what happened in the First World War. So the first myth that this game debunks is that Germany could have won the war if the generals had had their way. No, maybe it could have lasted a bit longer. I doubt that. But okay, if you think you could last longer, do it. Here's the game. You are at the head of the German army. So you prove how you can do better than they did. And I tell you, in my experience, it's very difficult to do even marginally better than historically. Okay. And the second myth, or the second side of this clean Wehrmacht myth, is the idea that all the war crimes were the responsibility of the Nazis and the SS, and the Wehrmacht was innocent of it. And, well, okay, the minute you start reading about it, you realize that this is not true. This is not the case. I mean, it would have been impossible for the Einsatzgruppen, you know, the SS groups that came into Russia and also into Poland behind the German army, it would have been impossible for them to round up and exterminate and assassinate and kill all the Jews without the logistics of the Wehrmacht. And they were aided by Wehrmacht soldiers. And there are generals such as von Manstein that actually gave instructions for his troops to cooperate with the Einsatzgruppen, and you know those documents are still preserved. You can find them. It is true that other generals were not so happy about it. Okay, but you know the majority of them had no problems with it. Okay, so how does the game cope with that? I told you about the fanaticism track. Okay, fanaticism is a track from 1 to 9, which measures the identification of the German army with the Nazi regime. Okay, and it is in the interest of the OKW to keep that as high as possible. This starts at 2, and in most games, it goes as far up as 9 in 1942. Okay, there are even cases in which you can't raise it higher because there's not at 10. And then as the war as the tide starts to turn, this gets reduced, but not really back to 1. Okay, so it's rare for a game to end with fanaticism lower than 6 or 7. Okay, so this fanaticism track precisely reflects that. It's the identification of the German army with Nazi ideology. Also, there are cards in the game that illustrate that. There's one political directed card, which is called bribing generals. And that's something that probably we don't know much about, but Hitler gave generals such as Rundstedt or Rommel or Manstein huge gifts for their birthdays, for example. And these gifts consisted of money, but also estates, even estates that had belonged to the Jews. So there's a card that shows that. You also have the commissar order, okay? And you have the commando order. And you have the commissar order and you have the commando order, because those are the two orders that allowed the Nuremberg trials to condemn Keitel and Jodl for war crimes. Those two orders that were issued by the high command, and they were transmitted to all the commands, and they were carried out. Both the commissar order, which is killing commissars, Soviet commissars on the spot when they were apprehended, and the commando order, which is killing commandos on the spot when they were made prisoner. Okay, there's another card for forced labor. The lack of men in German industry and agriculture, which in the Western Allies and in the Soviet Union, it was compensated by women joining the labor force, and it was the beginning of the liberation of women. Well, you Hitler couldn't stomach that, and the Nazis couldn't stomach that, because the function of women for the Nazis was to have children, Aryan children for the future. Okay, so they couldn't have women who were supposed to be mothers working in factories. So what they did was to import labor, forced labor, and keep them as slaves working in the Third Reich. Okay, some generals, for instance, von Weichs, in his card as a general, there is a little rule reducing the prestige that he grants, because he was responsible for massacring partisans in the Balkans. Okay, there's another card, which is Slavic cooperation, which never happened, which is a card that allows Germany to approach the invasion of the Soviet Union from a different perspective, which what would have happened if the Germans had actually taken help from those people like the Ukrainians or the Latvians or the Baltic states or the Belarusians or Caucasian peoples, people who had suffered from the communist regime. What would have happened if Germany had accepted them rather than oppressed them, which is what they did? So you have that option, but you know what? This option has to be played by OKW, and this reduces fanaticism. Okay, so playing this card goes against the interest of the OKW. So there are lots of, both sides of the Clean Wehrmacht myth are debunked, I think, by the game. Okay, and that was one of the design goals of the game. In a way, it's like reading a book. Is it wrong to read a book about the Holocaust? It's not nice reading. So this game is a historical simulation. Okay, obviously there is an element of gaming there, but what you are doing is simulating what actually happened there. So you are like one of those live your own adventure books. You are taking part in history, and you are putting yourself in the place of those people who were by no means nice people.
Well, let's explore that a second. So when for example, like this design is going to ask players to kind of marshal resources, make military appointments, direct offensives, right? But what would you say to criticism that this design might obviate the agency that these individuals in high command had over the organized destruction of human beings, non-combatants, and accountability by high command for it? I mean, we've described like some event cards, for example, about forced labor and things like that. So they're represented in the game, right? They're touched on it. But it's certainly different feeling for players when they have the agency or they're responsible for certain things taking place versus when the game brings them to the fore. Right, like in the course of a deck where we're turning, it's a little less stomach turning to like have the game show that the regime is doing something without any player taking an active role in it and getting their hands dirty.
But it's players that have to make that decision. The commando order has to be played by the OKW player.
Okay.
So and it's not a card that is revealed. It's a card that is chosen and played.
And it's and these align with the incentives, right? For your player roles is set
exactly
up by their secret
exactly because playing the commando order, what it does is to increase fanaticism, again, the identification of the Wehrmacht with the Nazi regime, which is what the OKW player wants to do, because that is his goal. His goal is to have a Nazi army. Okay, so yes, there's agency there, and there are players doing that. Yes, definitely.
Do you feel that a game about high command has a greater responsibility to represent or acknowledge, you know, Holocaust, war crimes, and, you know, all this broad swath of the things that we're talking about, particularly like occupation and, you know, murder of noncombatants, everything like that, than operational games have brought to this subject matter in the past?
I don't know if it has a higher responsibility or a greater responsibility. I certainly couldn't have done it without including those things. Can anybody else do a game like this where these things are ignored? Yes, probably. But that's not my game. Okay. Now, games, strategic level games of World War II, you have players making hard, tough decisions there, not just the Germans. You are the Western allies. Okay. Mm-hmm. Are you going to firebomb Tokyo? Because this is a strategic decision that you have to take, which is often whitewashed. It's not openly described like that. Are you going to drop the atomic bomb on Hiroshima? Once it has been dropped and the point has been made clear, are you going to drop the second one on Nagasaki? If you are the Soviets, do you know what happened to Soviet POWs when they returned to the Soviet Union? Stalin felt that they had been contaminated by Western capitalism. So they were either killed or sent to war camps, to Siberia. Do you know what happened to the families of soldiers that surrendered in the Soviet Union? So does this appear in World War II strategy games? Not that I can think of, no. So do they have a responsibility to do that? I don't know. I'm not... I'm no one to judge other people. I know what I did. And I know that in my game, those sort of decisions, you have to take them. And you have to understand why you are taking them, because then you can understand why things happened the way they happened. And maybe we can stop them from happening again.
I mean, that's the hope, right? When we're reading about pretty dark material like this to make a design such as this one, we always think about the research we do for historical games, is it expanding our knowledge? But it actually does a lot to expand our empathy, just in general, right? Like, we grow our empathy by reading about history and, like, about a lot of terrible things. And so that's why it's always important to, when you're making a determination and design, right, to figure out what you're going to put in, what you're going to emphasize, what you're going to leave out. And there's a concern that with everything that gets... each element that gets abstracted, right, put in the background, you are somehow declaring some authorial intent that this is not that important, when oftentimes it's more a matter of, I could not fit this in the game that also emphasizes this, you know, because our games have to emphasize something where they emphasize nothing, right? Like, it's just a very, the more chrome that goes in that box, the more inscrutable it becomes for the players, I think.
Yeah. Also, I think this is something which is closely connected to simulation, to historical simulation games, because history is ugly. Because if you look back and you look back at the history of human conflict, it gets ugly no matter where you go, because people die, because people suffer, because there are bad people doing terrible things. So I don't think this is something exclusive of this particular game or even this particular era. Think about the American Civil War. Mm-hmm. Think about Antietam. You're playing Antietam, a game about Antietam. It's the single bloodiest day in the history of the United States. Not even in the Second World War, not even in Vietnam. It's the day when most Americans died in battle in the history of the United States. And you're playing a game about it. Okay. And is it wrong to play a game about it? It's not, because is it wrong to read a book about it? It's not about the topic. It's about the approach. It's not that topics should be canceled or avoided. It's that topics should be approached in, you know, the right way. Illuminating, illustrating, making people understand, making people learn.
Yeah, I think that amongst designers, there's probably not a consensus about what should and shouldn't be, obviously, like made into games and whatnot. But I do think that there's a growing sense, at least, that amongst designers, we understand that there's a difference between a game that is fun and a game that is engaging, right? Like there's, you can have players do some things that they're not going to feel terribly enthused about, but they know that that makes it a more evocative simulation. It will be it should inform the players of something when they're doing some unsavory activity or taking on an unsavory player role. But there also is an understanding that if they're engaged in the game, that they're that's still a successful game, right? Not everything that they play is going to be fun. And for other people, they don't really want to have that kind of game in their hobby. And by that, I mean like on their shelf, not like, I mean, some people are probably very fanatic about it and they also would not like it to exist in the hobby either. But I mean, in their hobby, right? In their practice of the hobby, they're probably going to play, you know, something else that's not particularly historic, that doesn't ask them to do any of these, take on these unsavory player roles and whatnot.
And also something that we may, you know, discuss later, but there are things that I couldn't bring myself to include in the game. For instance, the Holocaust. Luckily enough, this is a simulation of World War II at the strategic level. So at that level, the Holocaust didn't play a role, okay? Because, you know, the resources that were employed in it, you know, fall below the scale of the game. But I could not bring myself to create a card about Einsatzgruppen or about concentration camps, because I could not bring myself to play it. I can play the commando order. I can play the commissar order. These are prisoners of war. These are war crimes. Okay. But the annihilation of a whole race, men, women, and children, I couldn't bring myself to include that in the game. No, I couldn't.
Is that something, Carlos, that you knew you were not going to be able to do fairly early in the process, or something you kind of struggled with a bit?
No. I had very clear ideas. That was the first one. Second one, no swastikas. Mm-hmm. No swastikas in the game at all, because I don't like them. So, and I don't like what they stand for. So there are no, I think there's one swastika, which is in the tail of a Messerschmitt 262 in the photograph, you know, but it's not used in the game. If you look at the box of the game, what you have there is one of those peaked caps that the German generals used to wear, and they have a swastika here at the front. It's been erased from the box cover.
Yeah, I don't mind people becoming sensitive to that. that hasn't been a big loss to me personally in the hobby. I play a lot of World War II games, and I think we can kind of manage doing without it just fine. If you don't mind, I'd kind of like to switch gears a little bit and talk about Imperial Fever a bit, mm-hmm. which is your other design that is currently on the GMT P500. Would you mind telling us a little bit about that design? Like what the game is about?
Well, the game is about competition between great powers in the 1880 to 1914 period. So you have four players. It can be played with three players, and we're working on automata. And those four players are the UK, the United Kingdom, France, the Central Empires, which is Germany and Austro-Hungary, and what I call the emergent powers, which is the United States and Japan. And they are controlled by the same players. So what these powers are doing is they are competing in the international sphere. They are competing in a race war. They are in an arms war. They are competing in a naval war, naval race war too. They are competing on the diplomatic sphere. They are competing in prestige, and they are competing in colonial expansion. So they are competing on all those spheres. And it's what I like about the game is that, as opposed to the previous game, The Other Side of the Hill, where a full campaign can take lots of hours, you can play Imperial Fever in under 4 hours. You can play the whole game. It's a deck building game.
In
a way similar to Time of Crisis. There are differences with that, but it's basically the same mechanism. So you have your hand of cards, and those are your actions, and you can improve your hand by buying new cards, and you can adopt different strategies, both during the game and also with the engine, with the card engine that you create by buying those cards.
Why do you think players are still drawn to playing games about colonialism?
Why do you think players are still drawn to play games about the 30 Years' War?
I mean, I think colonialism is has greater representation in the hobby, wouldn't you say, than the 30 Years' War?
Because it's contemporary history. Also, the game is not about colonialism. The game includes colonialism, but that's not the main focus. Actually, you have like nine main actions that you can carry out. Guess how many of those actions actually have to do with creating colonies? Two actions. So out of your nine possible actions, only two actions are connected to creating colonies. And you cannot win the game just by having a big colonial empire. Okay, actually, you're going to lose if that's what you go for. You can't simulate this period that I wanted to simulate if you don't include colonialism and the scramble for Africa and that. It's called Imperial Fever for a reason, because it was mindless, because there was no rationale behind doing that. Now, why is this period so interesting? And I don't mean colonialism. I mean the period from 1880 to 1914, okay? Why is this period so interesting? I think that we can agree that if there is a pivot in contemporary history, that's the First World War. Okay, in many ways, the Second World War is a continuation of the First World War. Okay, and if you look at the period before the First World War, like the 30, 40 years before the First World War, between 1871, I think it was, and 1914, there were no wars in Europe. You had the Franco-Prussian War in 1871, I think it was. And then you have 1914. There were no wars in Europe. And all of a sudden, you have this Armageddon happening, this First World War, which is the end of European hegemony in the world. Okay, so that is what my game is trying to answer. What happened? Why did those 40 years of relative peace in Europe, absolute peace, you know, among great powers in Europe, which had never happened before. Why did that end in the First World War? What kind of competition led those European powers to run like blindfolded into this crazy conflict that was the First World War, okay? And there are lots of things going on there, okay? There's alliance building and things which are meaningful to us nowadays, how there were two alliances being built, one around France, one around Germany. There's Mayen, you know, Mayen, the strategic writer that wrote about naval power, okay, this American theoretician about naval power, and how he explained that in order to have a hegemony over the world, you have to be a naval power, okay? And this is connected to trade routes. You find that in 1870, something, Bismarck said that Germany didn't need colonies. It wasn't necessary for Germany to have colonies. Actually, Germany comes late to the colonial race. So why does Germany all of a sudden enter the colonial race? Well, it's because of prestige. It's because of the need to have a global sort of positioning in the world. So you need to have a basis all around the world to expand your influence. You need to protect your trade routes, okay? And creating colonies implies creating a navy. And by creating a navy, Germany antagonized the United Kingdom. Okay, and this naval race was also at the heart of why Britain joined the Entente with France, because Germany was building its own navy. So all these things, all this is what the game is simulating. So mm-hmm. the naval race is simulated, the alliance building is simulated, the colonial race is also simulated. And at the same time, the emergence of non-European powers, such as the United States and Japan, which would be very influential, you know, after World War I, this also happens in this time. Okay. So, and how you have to understand the game helps you understand why Japan felt it had been slighted. Because Japan did not understand if, you know, all European powers had the right to have colonies, why didn't they? Okay. And this idea that they won a war against China, they won a war against Russia, but they were cheated out of, or they felt they had been cheated out of the gains they had made from those wars. This contributed to a kind of mental state that led to Japan in World War II. Okay, so this is what the game simulates. You know, all these sort of tides moving, going around, you know, this is what the game simulates. So is colonialism there? It's there. It has to be there, because it would be true. It wouldn't be true to history if it wasn't there. But it's just one component. It's not a game about colonialism. Actually, if you look at the cover art, which is, you know, the temporary cover art for the game, what you have there is dreadnoughts. It's dreadnoughts, because I don't want people to think that this is a game about colonialism, because it's not only about colonialism.
It's interesting, because I think the end of the European hegemony point is very interesting during that period, but it's a very different story in terms of like what America is doing during that period, coming out of the Civil War, and specifically like when I look at their military adventures, like in Latin America, is that, you know, like the Nicaragua, for example, being like the preferred site, right, for a canal, right, to unify like Atlantic and Pacific trade routes and things like
that. Well, Panama.
Well, they moved to Panama after the Colombian Civil War, when they basically take it. But Nicaragua was the original site, like the preferred site. And then when they moved to Panama, then Nicaragua was being looked at by the, you know, Germans, Japanese, like folks were then looking at like, hey, why wouldn't we want to build a canal here? But it's just like interesting, because the story for America in that region is really about them trying to, they're kind of emerging like as a naval power that's going to try to seize this pinch point, right, in between these trade routes, because of the currency it's going to get them, while also preventing other powers from having a canal that would diminish the value of theirs. And then on top of that, with the emergence of, you know, companies like United Fruit, then it's about protection of transnational capital in that region. So then it's about meddling in governments and things like that. So even though the actions, I think, in the game aren't entirely going to be about colonialism, a lot of them are clearly like your design is threaded in a way where everything's still very tight knit, right? Like every action is sort of in a family. Like you can see how each action kind of lends itself to another and sort of moves, you know, within those incentives. Like it's just a matter of like, it's still, colonialism is a very big part, as you stated, like of that game. And I wasn't also trying to be super pointed about this. I in general think that players are still drawn to playing games about colonialism now. And I just find it fascinating that as there's like more sensitivity about that topic, there's still like a lot of folks who love playing those types of games, but they're looking for how we approach those subject matters, like how will they be different now than they were when, say, Martin Wallace's Struggle of Empires came out, which, by the way, I love that game. Like, it's just the system for that game is great. I do like Wallace.
It's lots of fun.
It's a fun game.
Think about here, Stand or Virgin Queen. You have colonialism there.
Of course.
And it's very important. You can't win the game unless you have some colonies over there. So any game from the late 50s or the early 16th century up to the mid 50s, any game having to do with international competition has to include the colonies, because, you know, that's think about the Anglo-French wars in the 18th century in Canada. Think about the colonies, the 13 colonies rebelling and being helped by France and by Spain, not out of the goodness of their hearts, but because they were the enemies of Britain. And you mentioned Nicaragua, but what about 1898, the Spanish-American War? Theoretically, it was actually all a trap. I mean, the main exploded in Havana from an internal explosion. There was no attack from the Spanish. But then you have Randolph Hearst, you know, and you have all the yellow press in the United States, stoking the flames of hatred. And it was hatred of colonialism. And when Spain lost the war and they were forced to leave Cuba and the Philippines, what did the Americans do? They turned Cuba and the Philippines into colonies.
Right. Meet the new boss, same as the old boss, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. And you have Patton fighting the Filipinos in the Philippines when he was younger. And you have the Filipinos fighting the Americans. And you have Filipino leaders saying that they were living better with the Spanish than they were living with the Americans. So All that is connected, and that's what this game is about. So you have the Panama Canal is one of the things that you can do as the Americans, but you also have the Spanish-American War, and we are forgetting that this is also the time of the consolidation of the United States as a continental power, because the United States wasn't all states; it was also territories.
Right.
And they had all the central United States, they were still territories, and they were consolidated in this period. This 1860 to the early 20th century, that is the establishment of all those territories. And it's also the genocide of the Native Americans.
Carlos, did you ever get a chance to read a book by Imawar called How to Hide an Empire? That's it's about American imperialism.
I will write it down.
It's very cool because one of the things that it knocks out, like in the opening chapter, is how when Americans visualize the United States, like its boundaries, they see the contiguous United, the 48, right? And that in silhouette. And maybe some Americans will see Alaska and Hawaii in that in their mental picture. But what they don't see is like Guam and like all the other little territories spread throughout. And so it's always
Puerto
interesting.
Rico.
Right. Puerto Rico. Yeah, exactly. Like it's just like, but it's just like when
it's a 21st century colony.
When it's a colony
in the 21st century.
When you show Americans this picture with the silhouette of all of these territories, most of them are like, what is that? What's this? Where did that come? Like they can't even identify most of these things, or it never comes up. And it's like a thing that the whole time we're in school, like no one ever shows us this map. No one ever really talks about these or speaks to them. And so it's like kind of interesting, you know, in the wake of like, say Pearl Harbor being bombed, right? Like, you know, Philippines are attacked, like number of other territories, you know what I mean? That are, you know, these American possessions are attacked as well, but they're not really addressed in the same way that Pearl Harbor is, where this is like, we give this primacy. This is the United States. They're attacking us type of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, we mentioned like a little bit, like Here I Stand and like some of these other games that we've played that kind of address colonials. I was just kind of curious, like how, I know you don't think that that's like the focus for Imperial Fever, but it is like part of the thing. But did it, given that amount of time and kind of how sensitivity has sort of like grown around this subject matter, have any impact on the way you approach the topic in general?
Well, you said that, there was a heightened sensitivity about this topic. I don't think there is.
Yeah.
I don't think there is. I mean, you know, there was a very recent new edition of John Company.
Yeah.
Very, very recent. You know what John Company is about? It's about
Absolutely.
The East Indies. And it's about 10 million Indians dying of hunger in the 19th century. But what do you do in John Company? you buy a manor and you retire and you get money and you buy a manor. Where's the famine in that game? Where are the victims in that game? And where are the people complaining about that in that game?
I think
about the infamous Traffic. Have you played that game?
Yes, I have.
You know what that is about?
Yes, I do.
You know what you are doing?
Well, opium trade, absolutely.
Yes, you are making drug addicts out of Chinese people who weren't drug addicts before you were there. And that's what you are doing in that game. You are selling opium to them. Okay. And I've been, because you asked me this, and I said, I'm sure there must be people complaining about this on God Game Geek. Guess what? There aren't.
there most definitely are.
The Plains Indian Wars, you know, this recent game by GMT?
Which one? Sorry?
Plains Indian Wars?
Oh, Plains Indians War. Paniska, right? I think John Paniska's
design. I think
it's called
Plains Indian Wars.
I think it's right. I haven't played that game yet.
You know what this is about. It's about expanding the United States through the prairies, the center of the United States. And you know, the Indians are these little cubes that are in the way. So you have to move them around, move them up out of the way. And what you are doing is genocide. Every time one of those cubes is moved from the game. And I've been looking today, this is a 2-year-old game. I've been looking at it today and there were no entries, complaining about whitewashing. And I don't think this is a problem. Why should we complain about all these things? Are these games legal?
Well, we should complain about everything. I think complaining is a great way to discuss.
But the best thing that you can do is, you can complain, you can give your opinion. Nobody does. Yeah. Nobody does.
Oh.
I invite you to go to Board Game Geek and look at the pages there. Nobody complains about selling opium to the Chinese. Nobody complains about John Company. Nobody feels bad about playing John Company and, you know, creating those nice enclaves in India and all those places. What you are doing is you are starving people to death. You are selling them English textiles. You are selling them that so that they depend on you.
I think
that's what you are doing that game.
There's a couple interesting things though to that. One is that the player roles in those games are as the folks in the company. So there's like this sense that the players who are playing it know that they're going to be doing despicable things and want to see it represented as despicable, you know? And then the other part of it is,
are you sure about that? Are you sure that people who play John Company feel that they are doing despicable things?
I think they know that they're doing despicable things, but I might be, this wouldn't be the first time I gave people too much credit. But I generally think that the players are kind of aware of that.
Yeah. I've played both games. Okay. And I didn't see anybody concerned with what they were doing, both in Famous Traffic and John Company. And I didn't see people being concerned with what they were doing or expressing any ideas that they were horrible people. You were telling me before about the other side of the hill. How have I made certain things? Well, these games whitewash this time, okay? Because these things are ignored. There are no deaths. There's no all you worry about is getting money. And as you said, it is okay. Because that is what the players have decided to do. I think that we are not being entirely coherent in the way we criticize games. And there are some games that get, all the criticism, and I can't complain because I really feared that the other side of the hill would get much more backlash. It has got very little backlash, especially once people really, get familiar with the game and how it works, okay? And so far, I haven't got any backlash from Imperial Fever either. So I'm lucky there. But why should they, when there are games that simply decide to ignore these things, these issues?
I think it's pretty hard to know how, in a lot of cases, how well or poorly a game is covering a topic without playing it, right? Like there's that's the first thing. And for games that, you know, take like some of these games in our historical corner of the hobby are extremely complex, very expensive, and super long. So if I've got a $200 game that takes 12 hours to play about any topic, the odds of me finding critics for it are, they're going to be thin on the ground, right? Because it's just, it's a lot. It's a lot to do, you know what I mean? And there's games that I personally don't really sound like my thing, or they feel like they handle a certain topic in a way that could be potentially very divisive or, you know, not to my liking. And as a player, by the way, not as like a designer who's going to just be sanctimonious and a prick about it. But I don't want to read a rule book for like, you know, 2-3 hours and then try to play a game for 10 that, and then spend all the money on it that I already know I'm kind of not going to like. That's just like a lot. So I kind of self-select out of it.
I entirely agree with you there. That's exactly how I feel. Are there games? Have you heard about This War of Mine?
Yes.
I've played it. I would never play that game.
It's interesting because I know so many people who bring that up to convey a game that illustrates the horrors of war for those who are not combatants, right? And I, because though I'm not a sanctimonious prick, I am a little bit of a prick. I actually thought
the game, isn't? Who isn't?
Who isn't, right? Some of my best friends are, but I felt like it was kind of undermining the theme of the game that every single time one of our little group of survivors died, there was a knock on the door outside. I just thought that was goofy. And I would rather it had a game of like this kind of, you know, I would rather the whole bottom fall out of it. And sometimes when I'm playing a game by a designer, like, you know, someone like Annabelle Holland, where the game sort of is fragile and will break in under certain circumstances, or like the bottom falls out. I kind of love that she just gives zero fucks about making the point and not really caring about my experience all that much. But I also like that because I, you know, she's prickly, the game's prickly, I'm kind of prickly. I just kind of like all the cactuses all sitting nicely together. Like, that's just kind of fun for me. But when we're making these types of games and kind of struggling, I do think like there's an element of, as players, we do self-select out of some experiences that we know we're not going to like. And I think that some designs make it easier to do that because they're very upfront. Like, this is a challenging topic. This is a game that, you know, might be satire, but if you don't have an ear for satire, then you're just, if you want to go around the world thinking everything is earnest, like, I mean, there's a lot of jokes you're not going to get, and you're going to have a very unpleasant time. In general, I work with cancer patients, so I'm definitely not that person. Like, I kind of need some gallows humor. I need like stuff to be, so even my fun needs to be a little bit dark sometimes. But I do think that there's an element of some players are going to get the thing. They're going to understand what the topic is. Not everyone's going to feel that it's handled exactly right, regardless of what that topic is. But I do think that with the sensitivity and the conversation around games, it's not all being had on Board Game Geek. I think some of it's being had on Twitter. It's in Discord channels. It's on Facebook. And this idea that there's just not a unified conversation. And also, like, what do designers talk about? Or what do people talk about at the table right after playing a game? I do agree that not every, like, there's not a lot of criticism that's public about some of these games. But I do think that there's always a conversation. And that contributes to a sensitivity because our play experiences are very intimate with other players, right? We're taking a break from screens. We're meeting in person. We're trying to have a beer and play this intense game. Or intensely complicated game, or sometimes just a light kind of fun game. But I think that because of the demands on players for these games, like the games you're designing, Carlos, I do think that there's an element of engagement where folks, there's like a lot of buy-in just to get them to the table, just to start playing it, right? Whereas I think Wingspan probably doesn't require as much.
There are two ideas that have come to my mind when you were speaking, and you are very right, and I agree with everything you said. The first one is, I said I wouldn't play This War of Mine, but I think that the game should exist. I don't think the game shouldn't exist. The fact that I don't like a game, or that I don't enjoy playing it, or it's not my cup of tea, it's not. It doesn't mean that the game should be cancelled. I think that there are two different things, and I think that we can agree on that. And the second one is, I think that from what you have noticed that I like controversial topics, or that I'm interested in controversial topics, because that's where you can find truth. That's where you can find where you can discuss things, and where these controversies, you need to be informed to have an opinion, okay? And the point of these games is to help you be informed about those games. Of course, having a good time and playing and winning if you can, but also be informed. I mean, you speak about colonialism. Well, this is colonialism. This is why colonialism happened. This is why it was so crazy. This is why it was so fast. This is why it was so mindless. So, this game helps you understand this controversy. So what I said about topics and approaches is not my idea. It's Volker Runke's idea. There's an article he wrote a short time ago about the other side of the hill, and he made that distinction, and I think it's very true. It's not a question of whether a topic should be addressed or shouldn't be addressed. That depends on people's tastes and so on, and I think the only boundary is the law. For instance, in Spain, there is a law saying that you can't glorify the Franco's regime. So you can't really make a game, and it's illegal to make a game where you get points for killing Republicans or something like that. That would be entirely illegal. Okay, so that's one thing that's the one thing that could. And the second thing is the market. I mean, if you are bringing out a game which is legal but disagreeable, then probably the market is going to regulate itself, and you're not going. I mean, maybe you can bring out a game of the Holocaust, and maybe it's legal to do it in certain countries, but people are not going to get that game. Okay, so I think that in a way, as I tell you, the market regulates itself, and the market, if you're bringing out a game that approaches serious, grave, dark topics frivolously, in a frivolous way, then that game is not going. You're not going to sell many games, and that's going to be a problem. And that's what I'm going to. That's what I'm trying to avoid. I'm trying to avoid frivolous approaches, black and white, simple approaches. This is a controversial topic, and since this is a controversial topic, here you have the tools. You think that what happened was crazy? You think that Germany shouldn't have gone and made colonies because that was what happened? You are Germany in this game. See what you can do. And I think that's, you were asking me, why are people attracted to colonialism and why are they playing games like this? I think that it's because people like history. And it's because we want to learn more about history. And we are interested in areas of history which are controversial. How many games are there in the United States about the Vietnam War? How many people would defend nowadays the way the United States handled the Vietnam War? But you have people playing games about the Vietnam War. I have Fire in the Lake, it's there in my shelves, and I play it whenever I want. I think it's a great design. And I like it very much. And you are, you know, you're using Orange Agent and you're bombing the jungle when you are playing that game. But you are learning why things happened the way they happened.
It's an interesting point, Carlos, because, you know, when you're mentioning too, like how informed we are is like an element of how sensitive we are to these given topics, right? So are we more sensitive now because we're more informed? Probably not. But I do feel that to some extent, I don't know that sensitivity is can be written off just because it's not coming from a more informed place, which is going to sound really goofy, but just bear with me for a second. I, like, my uncles know what kind of games I make, but two of them fought in Vietnam. If I had Fire in the Lake on the table right now, they're not. They're all going to be like, why the hell are you playing that? Like, why are you gaming that type of thing? This is a serious topic now. It's so some of it's about that proximity, right? In terms of like their lives and like, you know, their lived experiences and like, or even just in time, right? Like, you know, when we're playing, you know, and I'm playing Hannibal with a friend, like neither of us are veterans of the Second Punic War. It's just, it's not that fresh. It's not that fresh.
Or your uncles, or your uncles.
Or my uncles even, right. But I do think that like for some of these topics, it resonates a little differently. Like, you know, like I like Struggle of Empires. I've enjoyed that game a lot. I think the system and design are good. The original printing of that with the portrayal of a slave on the box, like you can tell they're leaning into, they're not going to whitewash anything. We're going to show you this and these actions. These are enslaving human beings. This action, you know, just like a lot of unsavory stuff in the game, but it definitely resonates different, I think, at the table to a person of color that's playing the game with you. And it's also going to feel very different as, you know, someone who's at the table with players with people of color who are like playing a game and enjoying it or trying to enjoy it, because you don't want other people to feel shitty and have a bad time doing anything you're playing, right? So, which is completely reasonable. And I'm really glad you brought up Volko's essay, because I thought that it was very well thought out. I did enjoy reading it, and Volko's always good for, when he writes something, even if I disagree with it, he's just a very thoughtful design mind, and I always appreciate that. And it was interesting because he brought up a thing in that essay. He was talking about kind of something you had mentioned too, like where it's just like the concern is that by addressing certain topics, the controversial topics in games, the worry is that people will feel like we're trivializing them with our design. I strongly suspect the opposite is kind of true. I think that there's an element in our hobby where folks feel that games are very evocative and the play experience can be kind of internalized and evoke something that can challenge our understanding and cultivate empathy. And so because play is powerful and immersive in its engagement, some folks worry that could be abused, I think, with the right or wrong design. You know what I mean?
I think I do. Yes, I think I do.
Yeah.
I think that move this to the American Civil War, Gone with the Wind. It's yeah. that kind of, I think, you know, that you can make things which with objectively considered to be wrong, if you bring them to the forefront and you make people identify with them, then suddenly they become acceptable. Okay. I don't know if you have seen Gone with the Wind, the film.
I have not.
Well, there's a scene about the Ku Klux Klan there. It's not just called the Ku Klux Klan. And obviously the good guys are the guys of the Ku Klux Klan. How do you say? Ku Klux Klan? How do you pronounce it?
Ku Klux Klan. It's very difficult to say, even in English.
Okay, so the KKK. Yeah. Okay, triple K. So there's a scene in that film where the gentlemen of the film go to punish, deserters and bad people because they have attacked a lady. And this is the KKK. But it's whitewashed. Okay. Mm-hmm. So there's a danger of doing that. But I think you need to do it intentionally. I don't think there's a danger of unintentionally whitewashing something. But I think the opposite is also true. You said sanctimonious, and I think that's something that describes our society, or at least a section of our society. I think that we tend to consider ourselves the peak of civilization and I just wonder what people in 200 years will say about us, about the fact that there were thousands and hundreds of thousands of people living in poverty and dying and without water while we are discussing imperial fever on the other side of the hill here in our homes all comfortably. So we have this idea that things are very good now, and we can look at the past and judge them, okay? And I think that we shouldn't so much judge the past as understand why things happened. And understanding doesn't mean condoning You don't have to condone what happened. But those were people just like us, just in a different period of time. So what was it that made them act that way? And that is what a game can help you with. You know, it's like live your own adventure, I said at the beginning. So that is where games are really useful. But if we have this idea, this sort of manichaeistic vision of history, where you have the good guys and the bad guys, and you look back and you judge the way people acted, well, I would like to see how people judge us in 200 years and so many things happening in our society. So only because I like to feel empathetic with myself, and I would like future people to look at us and understand why things happened, horrible things happened the way they are happening now. I also try to look at the past, trying to understand why things happened the way it happened. Judging takes us nowhere, because judging implies that you put yourself in a place where you are above those things. But we are not above those things. We are just in a different situation.
I don't know what they have to say. It makes no difference anyway. Whatever it is, I'm against it. No matter what it is or who commenced it, I'm against it. Your proposition may be good, but let's have one thing understood. Whatever it is, I'm against it. And even when you've changed it or condensed it, I'm against it. I'm opposed to it. On general principles, I'm opposed to it.
He's opposed to it. In fact, indeed, he's opposed to it.
For months before my son was born, I used to yell from night till morn, whatever it is, I'm against it. And I've kept yelling since I first commenced it. I'm against it.